Hello, this is your Polycast for Friday, May 20th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, still no breakthrough headed into the last weekend at the Capitol and the latest from the terrorism trial in Minneapolis. With just 3 days left in the 2016 session for passing bills, top House and Senate leaders, along with representatives of Governor Mark Dayton, they met late into the night to try to reach deals on the big outstanding issues. The transportation bill and tax bill left over from last session are still unresolved. They're also working on a supplemental budget bill and a bonding bill. Tim Pugmire has more on what's being done and what isn't.
The clock is ticking, but Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd and DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach were showing no signs of panic when they emerged from one of their closed-door negotiations. Dowd said he wasn't worried about meeting the deadline.
You know, I've said all along, we're going to keep working until the job is done. And, obviously we have some differences. And it's that deadline at the end that forces people to come together. And we're getting, the more we talk, the closer we get. And we'll just keep working.
Bach also sounded upbeat. He said they're in a good position to reach agreements and finish the work.
I mean, the whole legislative process is about relationships. And if leaders have good relationships and conference committee chairs have good relationships and they're willing to have a give-and-take process and willing to maybe accept some things that make them uncomfortable, each willing to do that. But it starts with good relationships between the players, and I think we have that.
The leaders said their talks focus primarily on the supplemental budget and agreeing on how much of the $900 million surplus to spend. They've set aside the contentious transportation funding issue. Earlier in the day, Governor Dayton said he was still hopeful for a transportation bill this session. If it doesn't happen, he says he wants $500 million left unspent and available for next session. Dayton said the end-of-session push is a test of whether divided government can work for Minnesota.
I'm banking that those 201 legislators are going to put the best interests of Minnesota first and foremost. I think they've heard enough from their constituents all over the state. I certainly have. Who's saying, get it done. Get it done this session. We don't want to wait another year to see if we can move Minnesota forward. And I'm still hopeful that they will face up to that responsibility.
Lawmakers are also now trying to craft a compromise bonding bill after the Minnesota House rejected an $800 million package of public construction projects Thursday. The vote came just one day after Republican leaders unveiled their plan. But the bill fell 12 votes short of the 81-vote supermajority required for passage. Nearly all DFL lawmakers and a few Republicans voted against the bill. DFL House Minority Leader Paul Thiessen of Minneapolis said Republicans never asked Democrats for input. Thiessen said the result was a bad, overly partisan bill.
This bill is an unfortunate, sad joke that House Republicans are playing on Minnesotans. We should vote no on this bill and get to work on a real bonding bill that will create jobs and strengthen communities in every part of this state. The clock is ticking. Let's get to work.
Republicans argued their bonding bill was a reasonable size and was geographically balanced. Republican Representative Paul Torkelson of Hanska, chair of the House Capital Investment Committee, said his bill focused on priority needs.
There's no stadiums in this bill. There's no civic centers in this bill. This bill is full of the infrastructure that benefits everyone in the state of Minnesota.
Earlier this month, Senate Democrats failed to pass a $1.5 billion bonding bill when they fell one vote short of a supermajority. Even so, the bonding bill isn't dead. A conference committee will try to put together a new version that can be voted on before the session runs out. As negotiations on the big issues plod along, Governor Dayton has been signing lots of smaller bills into law. The latest batch of 22 bills included a background check requirement for driving instructors, new regulations for eyelash extension services, and criminal penalties for non-consensual dissemination of private sexual images, also known as revenge porn. Covering politics, I'm Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
In a Minneapolis federal courtroom this morning, a 20-year-old FBI informant is expected to continue to testify about how his former close friends allegedly plotted to travel to Syria and murder abroad. Dwali Saikautau reports the latest testimony featured secretly taped conversations.
In a second day of testimony, Abdirahman Bashir said he was approached by an FBI agent in December of 2014. That's when he was still grieving the loss of his four cousins who are believed to have been killed in Syria from U.S. airstrikes. He told jurors he had already lied twice to a grand jury about his own plans to travel to the Middle East and came to realize, in his words, the FBI knew everything that was going on. As he testified about his change of heart from co-conspirator to FBI informant, his voice seemed to fade. At one point, U.S. District Judge Michael Davis even said to him, "Keep your voice up. If I can't hear you, nobody can hear you." When he did, the slender man in a dark suit turned often to look at the jurors. He told them, "I stopped being radical and started listening to my father and uncle." A lot of scholars, he said, say everything ISIS is doing is wrong. When Assistant U.S. Attorney Andrew Winter asked him if he also wanted to make money, he said yes. In opening statements last week, an attorney for one of the three defendants said Bashir had been given financial aid exceeding $100,000. The government had Bashir wear a hidden microphone when he talked with his friends, including the three men on trial, Mohammed Farah, Abdirahman Daoud, and Guled Omar. Prosecutors say they plan to present about 30 of the recordings. By the end of the day, jurors appeared dazed, trying to follow the complicated web of names, relations, and excerpts of transcribed audio on a small screen. Most of the conversations were hard to make out, with different voices, whispering, and background noise. Before court was adjourned, jurors saw several propaganda videos believed to be ISIS productions. When the prosecutor froze a last image and asked the informant, "What happens next?" Bashir answered, "An execution." One juror put her hand on her mouth. Outside the federal courthouse, demonstrators gathered to support the families of the defendants.
Words are not crimes. The government case is
full of lies.
Some represented Minnesotans Against Islamophobia, as well as the Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar. The mothers of the three men in their 20s again gathered to speak to reporters and describe their anger with the charges. The parents say the FBI informant is only trying to save himself. Fadumah Hussein's son is defendant Guled Omar. She spoke through an interpreter.
"You know that it's not truthful yourself. This case, from the beginning, the intention was to arrest our children."
As the trial enters its 10th day, Abdirahman Bashir will testify again, and it's expected the cross-examination by defense attorneys will be intense. Dwahli Saikautau, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
A juvenile justice facility in northeastern Minnesota has announced it will close by June 30th. The announcement comes less than 3 weeks after American Public Media's investigative group APM Reports filed stories on how Mesabi Academy handled internal investigations into abuse and the effectiveness of its treatment program. Tom Scheck has more.
Mesabi Academy said it will send the remaining boys at the facility back to the agencies that placed them there by the end of June. The decision comes after the State Department of Human Services and both Ramsey and Hennepin counties pulled more than 50 children from the facility earlier this month. Mesabi Academy also agreed last week to stop taking new placements at the request of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. One parent who complained about her son's treatment at Mesabi said she's pleased to hear the news. Lisa Torbola of Lake Park voluntarily placed her son Jacob at the facility in 2014. He had schizophrenia and was acting out physically and sexually. Torbola filed a police report alleging her son was physically abused at Mesabi.
"And I'm just really glad that these kids have gotten pulled and are put somewhere safely."
A sheriff's investigation did not find evidence to support her claims, but Torbola says she's still glad her son told his story to the media.
"And I'm going to tell him that, you know, I'm proud of him, that this was his story. This was something he has done for the kids as well."
Mesabi Academy accepted boys who were sent there by the courts after committing crimes, children in need of protection, and youth who could no longer be managed in the home because of mental health reasons. A spokesman for Mesabi Academy declined an interview request. He issued a statement saying allegations made through the media are not true. The statement also said Mesabi simply cannot continue to provide the level of care the youth need now that so few boys remain there. As of last week, Mesabi Academy reportedly had 34 boys in the 123-bed facility. The mayor of Buell, Sherry Swanson, said she's not happy Mesabi Academy is closing. Swanson said the city is losing its largest employer and will own a building that will be empty on July 1st.
I'm really shocked that just a few hit pieces from you people could cause so much damage to their facility when they've been doing what I've understood through the years to be a pretty good job.
St. Louis County is still investigating Mesabi Academy for at least four allegations of maltreatment. Some of those allegations surfaced after the counties pulled kids from the facility. Ramsey County Deputy Manager Megan Mose said earlier this week that they forwarded two allegations of maltreatment to St. Louis County. She declined to provide specifics, but dismissed criticism that their decision to pull the kids was an overreaction.
In this instance, we certainly felt like the health and safety concerns that we were seeing were significant enough that it was in the best interest of our kid to move them. So that doesn't, to me, equate to a knee-jerk reaction. It was a very thoughtful, considered process we went through to decide that that was the step we needed to take for our kids.
St. Louis County Attorney Mark Rubin issued a statement saying his office will continue to investigate any maltreatment allegations at the facility. The Department of Corrections will have a regular on-site presence at the facility to ensure the needs and care of youth in placement are being met. Four of the boys in the facility as of last week were from South Dakota. South Dakota Department of Corrections spokeswoman Mandy Nielsen called the closure a significant loss.
Mesabi Academy has been a valuable partner and effective provider for our adjudicated youth with complex behavioral challenges. And we are making necessary arrangements for our youth prior to their closure.
Mesabi Academy says it had 138 employees as of April 30th. It says it sent information on layoff and severance plans to its employees. For APM Reports, I'm Tom Scheck.
And that's your Polycast for this Friday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Have a great weekend. Our folks will be keeping an eye on the legislature, and we'll be back here on Monday with a complete report.